This story is of today, the reading from Mark, is a story of Jesus' visit to his hometown. And the story comes on the tail. It's just a chapter 6, and in chapter 5, we have these incredible stories of Jesus' healing. We have the demonic who is healed, who needs a whole herd of pigs for his plagues to fall into in order for him to be healed. We have the synagogue leader, Jairus, whose daughter is raised from the dead by Jesus. And we have the woman who menstruated for 12 years. I preached on that topic last year at week, and I said, 12 years, the women in this church can say, oh my God, that's a long time. In these healing stories, we are hearing about Jesus and the name that Jesus is making for himself. Crowds gathered wherever he appeared, we are told. He's at one side of the sea, and he travels to the other side of the sea. And when he gets there, crowds greet him. Crowds are afraid of him and send him away. But then he comes back to the other side of the river or the sea, and there is crowds again. It doesn't matter where he goes, crowds gather. That the crowds gather is kind of important to today's story when Jesus goes into his hometown, because we can assume from these earlier readings that the people in his hometown have heard the things Jesus has been doing. For the love of God, he goes to his hometown and he's just got these amazing healing things. And he walks in and you know that the gossip has started before he even gets there. He's been doing healings and teachings all around the area where his hometown was located. His hometown has heard of his miracles. They know his teachings. When he comes home, they hear him speak in the synagogue, we are told. They wonder where his wisdom comes from. They wonder, even while they are suspicious of it. They know of his deeds of power, and they are amazed, we are told. And still, they refuse to give him the credit he is due. The way that the neighbors and town folks go about discrediting him, even knowing what they know and what they've heard, and what they see by their very own eyes, is a desire to relegate him back to the family he came from. You know, Mary and James and Joseph and Simon, his sisters who don't even get names. They want to relegate him back to the ordinariness of his family, the blood ties and all of the social relationships that he's had in the community as he was growing up. They want to send him right back to his place. Jesus was a peasant, or as we might say in our culture today, he was working class. And the people from his town insisted in seeing him only as the person he used to be. They only wanted to see him and insisted on seeing him as only the one who had potential to grow into a person they expected him to be. Who he used to be and who they expected him to be. Who you were and where you came from 2,000 plus years ago almost always determined who you would be and where you stayed and what you did when you grew up, even more so than in our culture today. You gotta laugh at this. Jesus was bucking the trend just by the very fact that he was traveling. They didn't go to Seattle for a weekend trip. Nobody hopped on a plane to the Bay Area for a week. Probably because you had to walk. It would have taken a little while. But very few people traveled further than 5 miles from their homes, except on the rare occasions, especially in Jesus' culture, when they could afford to go to Jerusalem for one of the festivals. His traveling around was suspicious because those who traveled at his time were out of the ordinary in their community. Those who traveled may have only been the people who wield power over others, you know, the Romans, the soldiers, or strangers, the traders. Everybody was to be viewed as suspicious, and he was acting and being in a way that just confounded their explanations. He was by far not the only one to do miracles. I want to reiterate that. There were lots of miracle workers in this time. But it wasn't actually a common practice either. So where we got is this man who not only walked long distance, he performed miracles. And really, how many of us today have a school classmate that went on to become very successful and who we are absolutely stunned that they did? We can hardly believe that, like Jesus, they went out and did something with their life, because we remember them from high school. The problem is the consequence and the result of the people's failure to recognize Jesus as the man he had become, as the person he had grown into being, led Jesus to be unable to perform his miracles. Sorry, I'm not stripping, but I'm chubby. And it's a little warm in here. They stole his power by their lack of belief. By their unwillingness to see the person he had grown into, they stole his power. There is a connection directly between Jesus' ability to do great deeds and the faith of others in him in the ability to do those great deeds. The community's failure to accept the power of Jesus essentially strips Jesus of his power. And how familiar is that to us in this room? I believe it has probably been experienced by each and every one of us in this room in some way. We don't have to radically change our experience, or radically have some radical experience in order to change just a little bit and to not live into other people's expectations of us. I suspect that there's one or two people in this room who went away to college and came home just a little bit more independent, a little bit more worldly, and all the people in the neighborhood still treated you like little Jane or Jack, who used to really like his orange bicycle. Or you got your first job where you had your own money, and you started buying clothes you liked instead of wearing the clothes your mother brought home and thought you would really look cute in them. But people still wanted you to wear those outfits. They still couldn't let you go and grow out and change. This story of Jesus in his hometown is the story about people who refuse to see who we are and who we have grown into being. And it is a story of life-sucking, life-killing effect that can have on us. On a personal level, I can talk about that as a woman. There are many women in this room that probably have experienced or continue to experience some of this phenomenon just because of our gender and our culture. While women have made great strides in the workplace and how we are accepted and expected to be in some sort of workplace, there's still work to be done. That 75% versus 100% of the wages men are paid is just one issue, but I'll let that go for another sermon. And while this particular thing that I'm going to talk about hasn't affected me, I have many women who are my age where this has been an experience of theirs in which they consider, believe it or not, life-crushing cultural expectations. It's only been a few years, really, in our lifetime of every single one of us sitting in this room, I expect. Not really everyone, because if you're under the age of 30, maybe not so much, where the only role you were really encouraged to have as a woman was to be the bearer of children and the rearer of children. In today's culture, that has changed a little bit, but it still makes its presence known in that women are the ones who are most expected to leave their job and have kids. This is changing. I don't want to deny that. Men are leaving to join the workforce, or to join the role of rearing children. But because men still continue to make more than women, it is still most often the woman who leaves. It's not just women. It's not just men that expect this of women. Women expect this of women. It is still our cultural norm that we're the ones that are going to leave our careers. Now, if this is something you choose to do freely, all the power to you. I think it's wonderful. But the consequence of having this choice made for you, if you are a woman, is that you give up the opportunity for career advancement, for career equality. If you leave the workforce for 6 to 10 years to raise your children, or sometimes even longer than that, it is hard and rare for you to start back where you left off. Most of the time, you actually have to start over. As a divorce lawyer, let me tell you, the women, that they have to start over at minimum wage jobs where they cannot afford to support themselves. When this life is imposed upon you because you are a woman, it can be soul stealing. It can be soul power depriving. As LGBT persons in this room, trying to be what others expected us to be, based on your childhood self and the cultural norms, many of us know what it's like to be soul-crushing and spirit-killing. Remember the closet. Remember feeling you had to be married to someone of the opposite gender. Remember the unwillingness to live into your true self. I imagine people of color and people with different abilities, men who want to stay at home and be stay-at-home parents, families that are life-giving and are formed outside the cultural norm. Anytime we are denied our sensual identity, our essential identity, when it falls out of culturally imposed norms, our ability to be magical is stolen from us. The consequence of the projection of who Jesus was, based on where Jesus came from, is that he does not have power to do what I just called magic. There is a direct link between the ability of Jesus to do healings and the belief and faith of the people around him that he could do those healings. It was the community's disbelief, their desires to diminish and minimize this man in their midst. That's what stole the power from him. Again, I ask of you, how many can you relate to this? Where is your life? Where in your life has someone's expectation robbed you of your ability to be all of you can be? I spoke of the closets, how you couldn't be your glorious self because other people's expectation of who you were robbed you of being yourself. We lost our power as gays and lesbians. Many of us in our earlier times, our ability to perform miracles. Remember the time that this has probably happened to a lot of you, when a jealous coworker just couldn't believe you had surpassed their skill level and wanted to hold you back. How many of you have a story in the workplace where you were diminished and then you doubted yourself? It's not just others, it's ourselves. We impose some of this soul-killing, soul-stealing stuff on ourselves because we doubt when others speak to us, just like when they spoke to Jesus and let him know they didn't believe in him. Jesus couldn't do his deeds of power. When you doubt yourself, you lose all the power that you can be. Sometimes we lose that power for a long time, sometimes for just little bits of time. But I don't think it matters whether it's for a long time or a little bit of time. If it's just a moment, that moment was stolen from you. And it was stolen because somebody didn't believe in you and who you are and how wonderfully and gloriously made you are. We do this to Jesus even today. It's not only the people in the times of Jesus who missed seeing who Jesus really was. We do it. They were unable to see him through their blinders that they had put on based on what they knew about him, who his parents were, what his job was, how he shouldn't be able to be that wise or that powerful. We do that today. I just laugh because we just do it so simply today in exactly the same way it was done as Jesus. John's family's from Kentucky. Those of us from Oregon, what do we kind of do? We smirk a little bit, don't we? We have that little, know what kind of person that person is. My beloved Gail's from Klamath Falls, Oregon. Oh, that's right, so is Steve. They're backward. That's what we do. That's what we say. Geographic origins are a huge factor in how we judge people today. God forbid somebody's a Mormon, or a Catholic, or a Pentecostal. We still form judgments about how somebody is predisposed if they're of a different religious affiliation. We do this to Jesus, too. Those of us who've heard stories from the Bible, read the Bible, some of us who even have studied the Bible a little bit, we still miss who Jesus is today, the greatness of Jesus, who was 2,000 years ago great and still great today, just the same way the villagers did 2 millennia ago. We prejudge Jesus, not by historical data, but we prejudge him by religious traditions that we have been taught. Jesus was born of a virgin. Jesus was or is God. Jesus was fully tempted but never sinned. And then, in my deepest, darkest hours, I meet Jesus. Gentle and kind, loving and supportive, sometimes kicking me in the pants because I need it, but always loving and accepting me where I am in the moment and desperate to be in relationship with me exactly how I am and who I have grown into being. When I experience this, when I experience Jesus believing in me, not only does Jesus have the power to heal me, I have the power to be all that I can be. It isn't just others that limit our own judgments or our own interpretations of Jesus. We actually need to work hard on recognizing it when we ourselves do it to ourselves. We let those insidious thoughts pop into our heads and limit our ability, our own ability to do magic. If a painter believes that she is not a good enough painter because she hears those voices in her head or the criticism for those who cannot stand her magic on a canvas, and she believes it, how can you be an artist? Your dad's a waiter and your mom's a doctor. She may hide her natural ability to paint or sketch or draw, and we lose the magic and power of another Georgia O'Keeffe. Our second reading today, as dated and as misogynistic as we might want to feel that it is, that's a powerful reading to me about what happens to something as essential to us as human beings in our interactions as kindness, when it gets wrapped up in expectations and in rules, and how you get to deliver kindness, and how you get to receive kindness, and how all of that makes kindness no longer kind. Under the pressure of religion, Jesus becomes wrapped in the cloak of religious dogma, and so do we. So do we. Kindness, Jesus, love of one another is instinctive. It's inherent. Power and magic and the ability to do good deeds and to be one in accord in a relationship with Jesus is not the result of a special blessing of God or your family or your neighbors. It's not induced only when God approves. The rightness and gift of Jesus is ours for the claiming when we want it, and ours for the giving of the community around us. Jesus was born as one who would and could do great deeds, powerful, miraculous deeds of healing and loving and teaching. Jesus becomes powerless when those around him just cannot see him for who he is. Those around Jesus and we today need to have faith in who he was and who he is, Belief in things that we hear and that we observe, and not in things that we remember and are holding on to from long ago. We too become powerless when people refuse to see us for all of who we are, and when people refuse to trust what we are telling them about ourselves and our insights and our experiences and our knowledge and our relationships that have brought about great healing. When we are held back by how others want us to see, how others hold us back, we are not free. So I think our first task is to free Jesus. Free Jesus from all that you think and heard and have believed about who Jesus is supposed to be, and open yourself up to meet and greet Buddy Jesus. Learn to send away the voices inside of our heads, the ones that limit us by telling us where we came from and therefore how that limits us with where we can go, the ones that judge us and robs us of our very essence to just be our very best selves and the very selves we were born to be. There are many things I love about MCC, but I suggest to you that MCC and the faith I have developed here has been most gracious and encouraging to metamorphose from this uptight, rule-making, rule-judging person that walked through these doors almost 27 years ago. You are invited into that kind of relationship, because here in the community we have here, and the community that we must take outside of these doors, is a community that says, I welcome you and I greet you how you are. You don't need to tell me anything about who you are yet. Right now, right here, welcome. And if somebody needs some time to change and grow into the miracles and the power, we're going to give you that time here. And the one way that we do that is because we have Mormons and Catholics and Pentecostals sitting next to a Presbyterian and a Mormon and a Jew and an agnostic and an atheist. We're all here. And we say, welcome. I think our community and our social ties here in this church encourage the faith in us, our faith in Jesus Christ, to grow out of those stupid rules. We do this by trusting in the miracles that we see Jesus performing in others and in ourselves. And in the wise words of one Gail Boumala, and for those who are new, she's my beloved spouse of 25 years. Whenever I say to her, she says to me, why do we have to do that? I always tell her it's in the Kimberly Book of Rules. To which that dear woman replies, and has replied for almost 26 years, I threw that book away. Amen.